From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. Always nice to have you. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. Let's open the week in review with a powerful story of two people who grew up fearing each other, but now work together. In 2006, a group of Israeli soldiers joined a group of Palestinian fighters and decided to lay down their weapons. They created an organization called Combatants for Peace. They decided that tanks and guns and bombs were never going to create a lasting peace. Today, they travel the world, spreading the message of nonviolence while working toward a peaceful solution in their homelands.
Combatants for Peace came to Rochester this week. We heard from Osama Elowat, a Palestinian who shared what changed his heart. You'll hear him later in this clip. First, this is Michal Ochberg, a woman who grew up near Tel Aviv, saying she feared Palestinians because of media portrayals, and eventually she joined the Israeli army. She talked about how she now views her childhood as a kind of bubble that stripped Palestinians of their humanity.
I think in Israel you feel it. You feel that there is soldiers that are fighting and we have wars, but most of the soldiers don't meet Palestinians. Most of the soldiers can go in office and do many jobs. So not all of the soldiers are fighters.
Right, and often never meet a Palestinian, yeah.
Yeah, but for sure you know people that are fighters and are in the war.
So what was it that changed then for you? What happened?
I think I was confused all the time because I wanted peace, but I was afraid of Palestinians. And I think in the university, a few things happened to me. It was the first time that I asked questions, and I had this tool to figure it out myself, the knowledge. I had a roommate that she born and raised in a village that is very special in Israel. It's Jewish and Arabs that live inside Israel together. And she was from a very political left-wing family. And she gave me a lot of knowledge that I didn't know, and I was very confused and asked her. And then there was an organization that suggests students to learn more about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So I joined in for 1 year, and we read a lot of articles about our situation and about other conflicts in the world. And we talked about, and we went to tours. So I went with an organization that called Breaking the Silence to the West Bank. It was the first time for me that I was in the West Bank, in the Palestinian areas, and a lot of information about people that don't have rights, the Palestinians. And in the end of this process, we really wanted to meet Palestinians. So through a German organization, we had a seminar in the West Bank, German, Israelis, and Palestinians. And it became personal. Like, I met Palestinian in my age, they tell me how they live. It was very hard for me to hear things that were really new to me about destructions of houses and people that don't have enough water, young people that go to jail without a court, and a lot of things like that. I think from this event, from this seminar, after this year that I had a lot of information, I couldn't close my eyes anymore. And it was a very scary and very lonely process. And then I didn't know what to do with it anymore. I tried to talk to my family, I tried to talk to my friends, but I think it's not easy to hear things that you can easily don't see. So I ruined a lot of Friday dinner with my family. I think in the beginning of the process, you're really mad, and you really want everybody to know what you know, and it's really hard to listen to someone like that. So for me, to not be alone with this, not to be crazy, I wanted to find a group to be active with her. So I joined Combatants for Peace 7 years ago.
What did your family say, though, when you would bring, as you say, in Friday night dinners, what did your family say when you raised your concerns?
A lot of argument. I think in general it's really easy to blame the other side, especially if you don't know them. I told that my family was left-wing, but I think after a lot of violence, in 2002, most of the Israeli society went more to the right side, and also a few members of my family. So a lot of facts, without knowing Palestinian and without going to the West Bank and Gaza, Like, actually, I still hear from Palestinian and from Israeli the same question. Like, Israeli can say, okay, but we want peace. Why you don't talk to them? We offer them everything that they didn't want. And the Palestinians say the same. We want peace. They build settlements. They occupied us. Mm-hmm. So talk to them. It's like blaming the others all the time.
What happened to me is in 2010, I was invited by one of my friends to dinner. And I went to that hotel where the dinner is in Beit Lahem. And I found out that we're going to eat dinner with the Jewish people. I refused, and I went back, and I was sitting outside, and I started to hear these people talking about that they refuse to serve in the army because they believe that occupation is not a solution, and my people have right to live, and they are against the occupation, and they are against violence. And I was, that makes a crack in my life. That makes me go back and think a lot how these people see me as a human being, and I still see them as enemies. And this, from there, the process start, and I started to meet more and more people. I started to meet Israelis as a human being. I started to understand them, to understand their narrative, to understand their fears. And I reached this knowledge that my enemy is not the Jewish people, and their enemy is not me. Our enemy is our fears. We both are very separated, very far from each other. All what we hear about the others is bad things, and sometimes we both improve these things. The soldiers were improving how bad are Jewish people to me every single day. And of course, the bombs inside Tel Aviv and Jerusalem was showing them how bad we are. So I decided with these people who showed me something else, the other face of Judaism, the other face of the Jewish people, of the Israelis, I started to work with them, and I understood from there that the only way is to meet the others.
Next, a conversation about Americans' perceptions of Muslims and Islam, and Muslims' perceptions of the United States. Recent data from Pew Research shows American opinions of Muslims have warmed a bit in the last several years, but stereotypes and stigma are still attached to Muslims and the Islamic faith.
We sat down with Tabassum Javed, president of the Islamic Center of Rochester. He says America was more welcoming of Muslims and international travelers about 40 years ago when he came to the U.S., but he says that has changed.
At that time, United States Information Services, you know, had a concerted effort they made in every city, actually, in all over the world, and to have these libraries and have access to information as to how to enroll in colleges in the United States and how to get the student visas, how to have the exchange facilitated so that people could put the money over there and have it, you know, recovered over here to be able to pay their tuition. So basically, it was a very big effort, a very big push for the world to see what America stood for and what America was all about. And now when I think about it, is I just was on a visit last year in Pakistan, and there were some young folks in my extended family, you know, cousins, children and everything. And I said, you know, are you interested in coming to the United States for studying? And they unanimously said no, because they said the barriers that are there in terms of getting the visas, and also the you know, the level of discrimination they felt in terms of being a Muslim coming to study here. So the perceptions totally changed. It's a 180 degree turn in terms of what I experienced and what they have in their mind that they would experience or may experience.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask some questions, and we're going to talk this hour about, you know, sort of what surveys say are opinions of Islam or understandings or misunderstandings. And there's always a risk in overgeneralizing. I mean, you know, when we say things like, well, what do Muslims think of X, or what do Americans think of X, or what do American Muslims think of X, or what do Pakistanis think of? We got to be careful, I think, with that overgeneralizing. But I do want to ask, generally speaking, in your experience, either if whether it's your own family, extended friends back in Lahore and Pakistan, is the view of the discrimination that they are concerned about, is their view that that's the American political leadership, or that's America?
Well, when you are sitting 8,000 miles away, it is very difficult to discriminate between those two types of discrimination. Okay. So their perception can sometimes overshadow everything else. Like, they may hear that still in America there are host families who are taking in foreign students. You know, they may hear about that. But they may hear that, you know, well, maybe they're not taking Pakistani students. Maybe they're not taking students from 63 Muslim countries in the world. And therefore, they may not feel as welcome as they would have ordinarily. Whereas in the 80s, it was known very well all over. Even in Pakistan, it was known that there are many host families who would take foreign students from Pakistan, who would facilitate their getting accommodation, who would facilitate them in many ways, and who would have an open arm policy. And if you ask me, as my experience, you know, in terms of, I was welcomed very, very nicely by all the American families who were affiliated, you know, as being part of the host family group. So my experience certainly was very positive. But that's going back at that time, not when the, you know, the environment has been poisoned by views which are derogatory about Muslims.
When you look at the data now, and I'm going to go over some of the data that Pew has collected over the last couple of years. Some of this is their own direct data. Some of it is them collating what they're finding among different surveys here. So let me just read a little bit here, and we'll talk about individual points here. Pew Research Center asked respondents to rate Muslims on a feeling thermometer, and they ask respondents to rate Christians and Jewish people and atheists, etc. So they use what they call a feeling thermometer, ranging from 0 to 100, where 0 degrees indicates the coldest, most negative feelings, 100 degrees the warmest, most positive feelings. On average, Americans give Muslims a thermometer rating of 48 degrees, which, by the way, is 8 degrees warmer than it was in 2014 when the center first posed the question. But it is the only sort of categorized either major religion or atheism that's less than 50. Atheists come right in at 50, and Americans don't generally view atheists very kindly.
Right.
And so there's two things happening. Americans' views towards Muslims, generally speaking, are getting warmer, but they are still cooler, significantly cooler, than other organized religions and cooler than atheists even. And I wonder how, first of all, generally speaking, what you make of that.
Well, I really still think that they know less about us. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where everything is at in terms of, you know, so like, that's why I know that my job and the job of all the, you know, 1.5 billion Muslims in the world is to keep telling people as to who we are and what we stand for. Because Muslims, even in America, are doing tremendous amount of community work. I mean, when the floods hit the Midwest, the number one organization to go was Helping Hands, which is a Muslim organization, went out to help out. There are clinics all over the United States. In fact, one I remember is called Mecca Clinic. It's in Jacksonville, Florida. And it is a clinic where no questions are asked. 30 doctors volunteer their time, 30 Muslim doctors. And people who have no insurance and no services they ever received in the medical area are welcome there, no questions asked, and the clinic is run by contributions by the Muslim community. So this is just an example of that. Now think about that those patients, those 3,000-4,000 patients who went through that clinic, their perception of a Muslim and Islam is going to be absolutely different, you know, like dramatically different than the one who hears only negative things from the media, or who visits sites where there's nothing but hate being spewed, or who listens to certain radio stations or certain talk show people who only spew hate about the faith. So there's a big difference.
Finally, we welcomed one of America's leading public intellectuals. Harvard Law professor Larry Lessig has spent the past decade railing on a single issue that he calls the single most important issue in American politics. Lessig says, we don't truly have a representative democracy because our political campaigns rely on big money and donors. The result, Lessig says, is a government responsive to a very small group of ultra-wealthy citizens.
He joined us on Connections to describe his ideas for real reform. He says both major parties are filled with what he calls fake reformers. Let's listen.
What we have not tried is to change the way we fund campaigns. So that's what vouchers would do. You know, for every president between Nixon and Obama funded their campaigns through presidential public funding. Now, that kind of public funding is different from vouchers. It was basically, once you qualified, you got a check. And that's not what I'm advocating for members of Congress. But it is important to recognize how different the world was. So when Ronald Reagan ran for re-election in 1984, he attended 8 fundraisers. When Barack Obama ran for re-election, he attended 228 fundraisers. So, you know, you might think, how does the president of the free world the most important man in our government actually do his job if spending all the time raising money. But that's what the system requires when you take away public funding in the system. So as much as I think it would be great to solve this at the presidential system again, the more important place to solve it, the thing we have not yet tried, that we came very close to trying in the 90s, and actually the Democrats blocked it in the 90s, is public funding of congressional campaigns. And that's the issue that you can tell differentiates a credible reformer from a fake reformer. If you're not willing to talk about funding congressional campaigns differently, you're not serious about changing this corrupt system.
So what is it that is going to actually move the needle? Because I suspect, Professor, if we went back the better part of a decade or more and told you that in 2019 we'd be sitting here with essentially no change, status quo entrenched, that it would be very frustrating, but maybe not totally surprising. But how do you do that? I mean, we don't really have political leaders at the very, very top calling for this. We've got some members of Congress, not a whole lot. How are you going to get this done in a system this big?
I am incredibly optimistic.
You are?
About, first of all, the public's understanding of this issue. Hmm. You know, when I first started talking about this a dozen years ago, most people were incredibly, confused about why this was an important issue. I remember people pushing climate change legislation. Thought, you know, we don't have to worry about money in politics. We'll just get a Democratic control of Congress and then we'll pass climate change legislation. And what we know now is that people on the right and the left are fundamentally frustrated with the corruption of the system, and they attribute the corruption to the corrupting influence of money in politics at numbers above 80%. And there's no difference between Republicans and Democrats about that. So that's real progress. When the people get it and the people are deeply frustrated and the people are demanding something, and it might be the one issue that all of us agree on, that is an extraordinary opportunity for leadership. Now, the depressing part of the story is exactly what you said. We don't have any leaders yet who are standing up and saying, look, we might differ about single-payer health care. We might differ about climate change legislation. We have all sorts of fights about immigration. These are all our differences. But let's start with the one thing we all agree on, that this is a corrupted government that we have to change if we're going to get anything else serious done. And so as depressing as it is to recognize that we still don't have a presidential candidate who is making this central, I think we have the environment where such a candidate could be enormously successful if he or she did that. And so that gives me endless optimism that maybe one of them will.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR, that's 88.5 FM. And if you're in the Finger Lakes region, 89.5 FM, that's WEOS.
We are also on the WXXI mobile app. Hey, no mistakes this time, Evan Dawson. Good job. Well, good job, everyone.
There's a few edits.
Well, not that they'll hear.
They'll never hear them.
I'm Megan. He's Evan. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you Monday.